now, here's Jack Paddy.
Good morning and welcome into the 9 to 10 show, American DA Live for Friday, July the 17th. And Ray is on assignment. we have Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Lahren with us this morning. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Jack. Happy to be back.
Hey, it's good to have you here. Always enjoy it when you come on the program.
Well, thank you.
Brought to you by, where's my note? Oh, yes, Landscaper's Corner, located here in Lexington at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. They're celebrating their 10th year in business. Your one-stop shop for all your landscaping needs. Call 225-9433. Our question of the day, brought to you by United Structural Systems, your foundation repair and waterproofing experts, ifixfoundations.com, 859-254-7700. Ray likes me to ask him our questions of the day, Dan. You want to?
I'll do my best.
All right, our question of the day today is, pet owners, do you let your pets sleep in the bed with you?
No.
Are you a pet owner?
Not yet, but when I am...
They won't.
Bed's off limits.
All right, yesterday the question was, Maine recently eliminated concealed weapon permits, saying gun owners now can carry concealed by right instead of by permit. Should Kentucky follow suit?
Well, Jack, as a CCDW holder myself, in theory, I agree. In principle, I know a lot of people that really don't need to be walking around armed.
Yeah.
Is that a lawyer answer for you?
It's a politician.
Politician answer. You didn't answer the question.
Sorry.
Do you think we should have to have a permit to carry concealed?
I'm gonna stick with yes on that one.
Are you?
I think so.
Okay, just because of the idiots. Just because of those that are challenged mentally or whatever.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right.
Fair enough.
What happened was a real almost a tie. 54% said yes. 46% said no. So I would call that pretty much a, what do they call that in poker?
Push.
Push, yeah, that's what I was trying to think
of,
a push. All right, we're going to talk about something today, and there's, I guess, a little bit of sensitive nature to it because there is the possibility that something else is going to happen, and so anytime that occurs, and any of you regular listeners know, we will never do anything that in any way jeopardizes a case, but We've got a case that you, I think, along with someone else, prosecuted a few years ago, right?
That's correct, yes.
And that's involving Carlos Taylor and
conviction
on reckless homicide. And then that was in 2011, and he served just over half of his five-year sentence and now has come to the attention of the authorities once again. Now, again, you say what you can say and don't
Absolutely.
Say what you can't.
Well, the rules are such that once a case is completed, I can tell you anything about it. And
okay.
I'll do that about the case that we had about 5 years ago against this individual.
Okay.
Mr. Taylor, it is a matter of public record that Mr. Taylor has been arrested and charged with felon in possession of a handgun and attempted murder. And he was arraigned on that case. To be honest with you, Jack, that's all I know about the case. I looked it up on our information sources, and so it's a matter of public record that he is facing those charges.
And it's not in Fayette County, right?
No, I believe that it's in Jessamine County.
Okay. So that's what we know,
right.
But we're not even going to talk about that today.
Nope.
We're going to talk about what we can talk about, and that is the Carlos Taylor case as it applied to Fayette County. I guess start wherever you want to, Dan.
Well, this case starts, like a lot of our cases do, with a shots fired call back in January of 2010. This was at one of those apartment complexes when you go out Nicholasville Road and turn left by where the Kmart store is and, you know, in that general area.
Right.
And it's the kind of place where the apartment complex was kind of a U-shape or a square shape with a parking lot in the middle. And the police get 911 calls that there are shots fired, man down. The patrol units go out and they find the victim who was eventually identified. His name was also Carlos, which was somewhat confusing to us.
Mm-hmm.
But the police go out there. They find this gentleman down in the parking lot. He's not in very good condition. The EC crews come and get him, and he's transported to the hospital where he expires. The police began to do a canvas. The patrol units go through the area and try to find people that saw or heard anything. And in this particular case, we found two witnesses that were very helpful to us. And then we found a bunch of people that didn't know nothing about nothing. Which is something I'll talk about.
See nothing, didn't hear nothing.
A little bit down the road. Yeah. But the witnesses that we had who eventually did testify at trial told the patrol officers that they had seen a number of individuals. They weren't clear, but it was more than two. They heard a disagreement. They heard the gunshot. They saw the guy with the gun standing over the victim, and then everybody ran.
This was at nighttime, I assume?
It was. About 10:30 at night is when the call came out.
And what year was it?
This was back in January of 2010.
2010, okay.
So it was a dark. It was cold. I recall that it was there was some snow and that the weather was pretty bad. I'll talk about that, too, because it affected our case.
All right.
So the patrol officers and the first responders were trying to find out who these people were that were running from the scene. It took them a while to identify the victim. They had some various identifying documents that weren't entirely accurate as to the identity of the people that were carrying them. They had some other physical evidence from the scene. In particular, they found, I remember, a big fur coat, like a very flashy fur coat that the victim was wearing. They found a set of brass knuckles. They found about an ounce of cocaine some distance from the shooting. There were some other items that were located as well. So the initial problem is to try to identify witnesses, suspects, the victim. The investigation led to the identification of a friend of the victim's who had been in the general area. When his friend got shot, he ran to a nearby gas station, had them call 911 from their phone because he left his phone in the car or he had dropped his phone. So the police identified him. Through him, they found other people that had been in the area, that had been in the car or had been otherwise involved. And over the next 2 to 4 days, I think it was, they eventually identified a person who had been in the vehicle when the shooting occurred. It turned out that these men were in a vehicle in the parking lot. Dispute of some sort happened. They opened the doors, somewhat exited the vehicle. The shot was fired, and then the witnesses saw the man standing over the victim, and then everybody ran. How this case led us to the suspect was that through the man in the car and the other individual that was identified by the cell phone records and the people that the witness that ran to the gas station had identified. Basically, they just set up surveillance around these guys and brought them in, made a traffic stop, talked to them. They were less than forthcoming, which is something I'll tell you more about as our show goes on.
But what was the length of time from the crime to when they rounded these guys
up? It was
up?
About 4 days.
Okay.
It was 2 days until they found the witnesses, and then through the witnesses, they identified the suspect, and it was about 4 days later that they identified and arrested him. And As usually happens, when the suspect was interviewed, his first story to the detective was, "I wasn't there." And then they confronted him with some inconsistencies in his story, and he said, "Well, I was there, but I didn't do the shooting." And they confronted him with further inconsistencies, and the suspect said, "Well, okay, it was me, but I was defending myself." And this is the series, having tried a number of murder cases, pretty much everybody seems to go through this litany.
And lie until they get you.
Well,
and then lie again.
That's how I explained it to the jury. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so in this particular case, the detective used some what we call interview techniques. To be honest, it's where they kind of bluff the suspects, or they'll tell the suspects things that aren't entirely true. That's not something that juries like, and it's an unfortunate reality that our detectives have to engage in things like that.
It is legal, though, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah. What is it called?
Sometimes we call it a ruse. That's usually the legal term, that the police use a ruse.
Claiming that they have some evidence that they don't, or claiming they have an eyewitness that they don't.
Kind of borderline like that. In this particular case, the witnesses had identified these guys and said that the whole thing was a drug deal. The idea was they were going to trade an ounce of cocaine for, I don't remember how much, an amount of money. And when the deal was supposed to happen, it became what we call a rip. You know, the defendant was not going to purchase the cocaine. He was just going to take it.
And it's called what?
A drug rip.
Rip? You know? Yeah, R.I.P.?
Right. Just a robbery,
rip-off.
Basically.
Okay.
Right. They set the victim in this case, who was a drug dealer, which is another issue that makes it a little tougher to sell cases like this to a jury.
You got bad guys and bad guys, right?
I can't with a straight face tell a jury anything else because that's why these men were there.
Right.
So that's how it came up. But in this particular case, the people involved had gone to one of the big box stores out in Hamburg. And we had security footage that showed the vehicles. We matched the vehicle to the one that was found at the apartment complex. But the detectives, in bluffing these suspects, told them that they had imagery from this department store that didn't exist. You know, all it showed was that the trucks were there. And what they told the guys was, look, you're lying to us. We know that more went on. And then they would volunteer more information. And how that pans out for us is that we have to kind of sift through what they tell us. And if the witnesses or the defendants, for that matter, when they tell us things that they could only know if they were in the car, for example, that the guy was wearing a crazy coat, or they identify jewelry in this case, or they talk about the gun, what color the gun was, or things like that, then that corroborates what they say, and that leads us to believe they're telling us something that's true, rather than just spinning a story and hoping that the police will go away.
All right, we're taking a break. 253-59. Dan Lahren is with us this morning, assistant Commonwealth's attorney. We're talking about a case. The crime occurred 5 years ago. And we're going to go to the phones, but we were just having a talk off the air, Dan, about justice isn't necessarily swift. And this one sort of was, because the crime was in 2010. And
that's
the,
right.
The case was heard in 2011. That's pretty quick.
This case got to the jury about 14 or 15 months after the event, which is pretty quick for homicide cases.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to the phones. This is Jim. Jim, good morning.
Yes, I've been wanting to ask this question about when you're gathering evidence. Let's say there's two or more bad guys, and you put at the scene of the crime and you gather up these bad guys, if you put them in a paddy wagon or a police car, if you have audio and capture what they're saying, if you put them in the same vehicle at the same time, chances are those two guys or three or whatever are going to start talking about what story they're going to come up with. Are you able to use that information in court, or maybe gather up information that way to help break the case?
That's a very good question. You know,
you have a very good answer.
I have somewhat of an answer.
Okay.
I don't know if the wagon that the police use has video, or if they do, if they record it. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I know that the jail has video and audio when they book people that come in. They don't have it in the cells, but we have used that before. We listen to jail phone calls a lot.
I was going to say something that is, thank you for your call, Jim, something that we talked about numerous times on this show, which just amazes me, is every prisoner is told phone conversations will or may be recorded, and yet they give out all kinds of information on the phone.
It happens. It happens more than you would think.
Yeah.
But to answer Jim's question, we use it if we can. Typically, we can't use a statement. If they're in custody, they have to be read their rights. And a lot of times we can't use that statement unless they testify. And then if they say something different, we can bring the statement in as an inconsistent statement. So that's the answer to that one.
Well, this is a short segment. Give us about 4 minutes, and then we'll take a break and then come back
into
this.
Well, Jim's question touches on evidence gathering, which was an issue in this case. We call it the CSI effect. You know, jurors watch NCIS and CSI and all that. I can't sit through those shows anymore.
Yeah, I bet.
Because in those cases, they take a DNA swab off a steering wheel and they put it into a little silver machine, and then the suspect's picture pops up 5 or 10 minutes later. And it does not work that way in the real world. We have to gather this evidence. We submit it to our state police lab, and they're moving faster than they used to, but they still have so much evidence to look at that it takes months. And it's really not anything like TV. The problem is, when jurors come into a courtroom and they sit there and they listen to our evidence technicians and our lab experts testify, they want to see this sort of thing. And the general thought is, well, if they don't have fingerprints, then it must not have happened.
Or DNA, you know, probably.
Right. Yeah. And in this particular case, there was a big issue in that our forensic services team went out and they collected a number of things, you know, the coat, the brass knuckles, the cocaine, all that kind of stuff. For whatever reason, the weather was not based on the cold and the bad weather, they couldn't set up their measuring, their total station equipment. And so when they came back later on, and I don't recall how long it was, the parking lot had been repaved.
Oh, gee.
You know, they painted all the evidence they wanted, and then they came back to take the measurements, and somebody paved the parking lot over.
Oh,
and that
wow.
was
Did
a
it
huge,
hurt you? Did it hurt
absolutely.
You?
That was a huge issue at trial. So, you know, we took other pictures and took other measurements, but that really hurts us in front of a jury if our evidence collection isn't, because it's just not how it works on CSI.
Right.
So we try to educate jurors and explain to them that, you know, if we know who the guy in the car was, it doesn't mean we need his fingerprints or his DNA swabs and all that kind of thing. But it's still an ongoing issue pretty much in all our cases, not just murders.
I've heard people say, I'm not making light of this, but you'll probably get a kick out of it. You probably heard it too. My car was broken into, and the cops didn't come out and take any fingerprints.
Absolutely. Right.
And I mean, because we expect that if they do it on CSI.
Absolutely. We've had fingerprint experts from our police department as well as from the state police testify. And my recollection is that they get fingerprints in a very low percentage of their cases. You know, in a burglary case, the guys will try to take prints off the door or the window where that was broken in. You know, the majority of time, if they get those fingerprints, they're from the people that live in the house,
mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
and DNA swabs and that kind of stuff. It looks great on TV. In the real world, not so much.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959. It's 9:36, 24 before 10 o'clock, and Dan Lahren, assistant Commonwealth's attorney, is in the studio with us this morning. And in the event that you just joined us, we are talking about a murder case that occurred in Lexington in 2010, and in 2011, a Fayette County jury found Carlos Taylor guilty and sentenced him to 5 years in prison. He was found convicted of reckless homicide. Is it appropriate this time or later to do we wait till the end to say why this was reckless homicide?
I think that's my second to last thing I want to talk about this morning.
Well, we will understand that before the hour is over. And if you have a comment or a question, our phone lines are open. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. Proceed with your story, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, The last thing we had talked about was the CSI effect, the gathering of evidence. The next issue that I touched on this a little earlier was this idea about witness cooperation. You know, we've had a trial or two recently where witnesses just told juries, you know, snitches get stitches. And it's an unfortunate phenomenon that a lot of people in our community don't want to cooperate with the police or the prosecutors, for that matter.
Right.
And witnesses don't want to get involved because then the defense gets your name and your address and your phone number, and you have to come into court and testify, and the defense attorney cross-examines you. People just don't want to be perceived as helpful with the police and prosecutors that are going to incarcerate their friends, their family, you know, fellow gang members, their partners in crime. So this is a hurdle for us, and it's continuing to be one. In this particular case, we had the two eyewitnesses from the apartment who were very good witnesses for us. They couldn't identify anybody, but they had no stake in the case. The man that led us eventually to the shooters was a friend of the defendant's. He was somewhat helpful, but he didn't really have a lot there. For us, we identified the other guy that was in the car. And as it happened at trial, there was a self-defense claim in that he had been attacked by the victim, and then the defendant shot the victim to protect this other man from death or serious physical injury, maybe. And I'll talk a little bit more about that because it has to do with why this was a reckless homicide conviction and not a murder conviction.
Okay.
So it's an ongoing issue for us to get witnesses that will cooperate and will remain cooperative throughout a trial. And this kind of ties into the investigative techniques that I was talking about. These guys didn't want to come forward because they're drug dealers. I mean, they were engaged in illegal activity. Some of them probably had some other issues they were looking at, possibly being deported from our country or family law issues. You know, if you get caught up into a criminal case and you have child custody issues or divorce issues, that all kind of plays into it, which is why our detective explained it pretty well to the jury, and what he said was, you know, if everybody told us the truth, we would just have a big desk at the police station, and everybody would come in and tell us what happened, and then we would all go to the courthouse, and we wouldn't need detectives. We wouldn't need evidence collection. We could just have everybody tell the truth. Again, in the real world, it doesn't happen that way, and the pretty much any patrol officer or detective will tell you everybody lies to us. You know, people don't want to, they want to minimize their involvement. They don't want to come to court. I understand that. You know, the suspect has the right, as Ron White would say, but not the ability to stay silent sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We can't make the guys talk to us. So that's why our investigators have to do things like bluff with the security video or talk about other things to get the information we need to proceed. So in this particular case, all this wraps up and we go to trial. And when you put a guy who's, you know, an accused drug dealer or a felon on the stand, the jury gets to understand that and gets to know that, and it affects their credibility. And it makes our efforts to prosecute a case a lot harder, because jurors, I don't think that they care so much about, you know, racial backgrounds or so much even age backgrounds, but they care when people put themselves in a situation where there's going to be crime or a dangerous thing. That this is a good episode, you know, or a good example. If you're going to deal drugs, you know, people are going to have guns.
Yeah.
People are going to try to rob you if you're carrying a lot of money around, if you're hanging out with dope dealers. Another good example I think of is in our domestic violence cases, when there's an ongoing series of domestic violence and then the victim finally just has enough, and this is a burning bed thing where they kill the person that's abusing them. That's different than, you know, walking down the street and getting grabbed off, getting kidnapped, or somebody breaking into your car when they don't know you.
Right.
These things all play into the decision that the jury has to make in this case.
And the witnesses that you have in this case largely are bad guys, too. How credible are they to the jury?
That's a problem. You know, and as we like to tell the jurors, really it's the defendant that picks the witnesses. It's not us.
Right,
you know?
Right.
We have had, you know, a few cases where people burglarize innocent victims. We have otherwise credible witnesses. In cases like this, drug dealers shooting each other, it happens all too frequently. And those are the people that we identify, bring into court, have them explain to the jury what happened. So in this particular case, it became a self-defense issue. And I believe we've been in here, the last two homicides that I've had that I've talked about are self-defense. Everybody claims self-defense.
Of course.
And in this particular case, the way the evidence played out was that the guy in the front seat was the driver. The guy in the back seat was the defendant, Mr. Taylor, and that the victim got into the car, presented the cocaine to the defendant, who gave it to the driver to weigh it or to examine it. The driver began to manipulate the cocaine in a way to kind of break pieces off it, and then they gave it back to the victim and decided they weren't going to buy any of the dope. So basically, they stole cocaine from the guy. The victim was unhappy about this and punched the driver. The evidence was that he took a swing at him, he hit the driver. Now, as it turned out, the driver was kind of an amateur MMA fighter. I met the guy. He was a stout, big guy. But the victim had punched him and left a mark on his head, at which point the suspect said he was out of fear for his friend's life. He produced his handgun and shot the defendant. So when the EMTs came out there to treat the victim, a set of brass knuckles fell out of the coat that he was wearing, that fur jacket.
Ah.
And when they talked to the witnesses from the scene, nobody said anything about brass knuckles. But by the time the case got to trial, everybody knew about the brass knuckles, so the defense attorney made it look like the guy had used brass knuckles, a dangerous instrument, to injure his friend, which would justify the use of deadly force against the victim by the defendant. So it becomes a bit of a harder sell, coupled with the fact that everybody involved is using or selling narcotics.
Right.
Jurors will tend to kind of give they won't get as excited about something like that as they would for, you know, a guy that was making a bank deposit and people rob him.
Right,
or shoot him.
Right, an innocent, really innocent
right,
victim.
Right, yeah. And I couldn't stand in front of a jury and really say that the victim in this case was an innocent man because he went there to sell narcotics and they tried to rip him off.
Just so I understand, the brass knuckles actually complicated the thing for
Absolutely.
You. Absolutely. Because that's a dangerous instrument. Is that what it's called?
Right.
Same as a knife or...
Right. The distinction for us, a deadly weapon is basically a firearm.
Okay.
You know, a dangerous instrument is a knife, a nightstick,
a
brass
club.
Knuckles, a club, that kind of thing.
All right. All right. Let's take a break and keep that thought.
You bet.
2-5. We got some territory to cover here in about 5 minutes. Our guest this morning is Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Dan Lahren. And I guess this is tying up loose ends and telling us what happened in the trial here, Dan.
Okay, well, we tried this case. My recollection is that it was a 2 or 3 day trial, and all of these things that I've been talking about had an effect on the verdict. You know, the fact that our forensic service evidence was not as good as it could have been because the parking lot had been paved over hurt us quite a bit. Our witnesses, other than the two eyewitnesses, one of whom, oddly enough, had an optical condition where he wore these blue glasses when he came into court. So
that's not a great eyewitness.
Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah.
He had, you know, but they were solid, but you know, everybody else involved was a drug dealer or a felon.
Right.
That was bad. The defense managed to exclude some unsavory things about their client. You know, we're not always allowed to tell.
What kind of a record did Mr.
Well,
Taylor have?
Well, at the time, he was 19 years of age, so he did not have an adult criminal history.
I see.
You know, his self-defense argument, in my opinion, wasn't a great one, but it was there. You know, we had the brass knuckles. He was trying to defend his friend, or so he said.
Reasonable doubt. That's
right.
There was
some reasonable doubt there, I think. If you act in self-defense and you use too much force, you get a reduction. You know, without boring you with the legal details, it'll reduce a murder to a manslaughter. And in this particular case, in my opinion, I think the jury wasn't too happy with the fact that the victim had put himself there, that it was a narcotics deal, that the physical evidence didn't really push one way or the other, and they convicted him of reckless homicide. So that's the lowest level of homicide. It's a Class D felony. It's eligible for 1 to 5 years. Oddly enough, under our statutes, it's not a violent crime.
Ah!
So somebody's dead
and it's not a violent crime?
I just try to execute the laws that they
have. You don't make the laws, you just execute them. But
we try to enforce
them. That's ridiculous.
It's very odd. But if a murder, a manslaughter, you know, where you use a firearm, crimes against children, things like that are violent offenses, which you're not eligible for probation. You serve 85%.
Yeah.
Reckless homicide is not that. So that's what the jury came out with, and I understand how they reached that decision based on the evidence we had and the way the case went at trial. He was, I have to say, pretty well defended by his attorney, who in his opening statement had the brass knuckles out and was punching the podium with him and all that kind
Doing
of stuff.
Doing a Johnny Cochran on you there.
Yeah, well, that's what they do.
Right,
So he got a 5-year sentence. He went in April of 2011. Now, and here's where kind of the crux of this whole thing. I'm looking at his corrections records. He had a 5-year sentence. He spent most of it at the Fayette County Detention Center. Because he was convicted of a Class D felony, therefore under corrections, he never went to a penitentiary.
Okay.
So he was here. He went to the Hopkins County Jail for looks like about a year, and then he went to a halfway house, and then he was released in December of 2012. Now that's 2 years and 10 months on a 5-year sentence. And you wonder how that happens. In looking at his corrections records, when inmates are in the system, they get what's called a good time credit or meritorious good time, basically for not creating problems. Right.
Yeah.
They get time off their sentence. And it looks like he got one of those pretty much every month. They knock 7 days off. He got some good time credit for completing educational programs and some meritorious good time awards. What that boils down to is, you know, with a 5-year sentence, you would think that he would still be in jail 5 years from when he started.
Yeah, one would think.
Right. Unfortunately, it does not work that way in the real world. And this is just kind of how it works. We say we have truth in sentencing. That's not entirely accurate.
Because
if it was truth, if he had a 5-year sentence, he would serve 5 years. And in this case, he had a 5-year sentence. He served two years, 10 months of it, was released, and you know, here we are. He's back in the system, and here we go again.
Yeah, and he's and can't talk about the thing coming up because it's coming up. But it's a good example of as Ray likes to talk about criminals that do it for a living.
I think that's fair.
Yeah, that's their job.
Right.
And if they're the only time they're not doing their job is when they're in jail where they can't do their job.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure, Dan.
Happy to be here.
Update from the Information Center next, live with Lee.